Welcome, everyone, to the August meeting of the Delta Independent Science Board. I now call the meeting to order. And we'll start with public comments, an overview of the public comment process. So we can take written questions and comments, and you should follow the instructions either on the meeting notice or on the screen, which will appear in a minute. And then while that's coming up, here we go. So here's the email you can contact to provide public comments. Or you can use the raise hand function in Zoom. So now we will go on to our roll call. So please state your name and whether you have any new declarations. Virginia.
I'm Virginia Dale. I have no new declarations.
Tanya.
Tanya Heikela, no new declarations.
Tom.
Tom Holzer, no new declarations.
Diane.
Diane McKnight, no new declarations.
Anna.
Anna McCulloch, no new declarations.
Bob.
Bob Nyman, no new declarations.
Obey.
Jayanta Obaisekera, no new declarations.
Inga.
Inga Vernon, no new declarations.
And I'm Lisa Wanger, and I have no new declarations. Okay, few housekeeping tips. I'm going to turn it over to Margo Mattson to discuss those.
Just to remind everyone that in event of an evacuation at the Resources Building, everyone should remain calm, take all of your belongings, and proceed to the nearest exit. Staff will gather at the evacuation point located at 1615 9th Street, and the public is welcome to join. Please remember that there's no food or beverages allowed in the meeting room. Thank you.
Thanks, Margo. So I just want to give a quick overview of the agenda. It's deceptively simple, but I think it's going to take all the time we have. So we have the exciting opportunity to elect a new chair-elect. We'll discuss the status of our reviews and get into detail on the subsidence review draft, and we will discuss future activities. So with that, I'll just check in if there are any public comments.
There are none.
Okay. Moving on to agenda item two, the chair's report and business matters. So we're planning to review and comment on the draft Delta Adapts adaptation plan, and we're waiting for the public release of that report. So we had a presentation, and as a reminder, Obey has offered to take the lead on drafting that comment letter, but we're still in a holding pattern for now. We will receive a presentation from the Delta Stewardship Council staff in the near future on the draft environmental justice paper, and they'll be looking for informal feedback and discussion. Also, an important event, there will be a matching workshop for the next California Sea Grant Fellow from September 16th to 18th. And so this is the time when we say who we're interested in and the fellows say which groups they're interested in working with, and hopefully the matching happens. So Dylan Chappell, Shoko Shinbrot, and Marga Mattson will be participating, but we're also looking for an ISB representative to participate in this process. So but unfortunately, both Inga and I have conflicts those dates. So if you're interested, please let staff know. This is how we get our next fellow. And so far we know we want that new fellow to contribute to the contaminants review and the workshop on the state of climate change research. But we're also having a discussion today on new directions. And so that could inform what kind of expertise we're looking for in a fellow. All right, next item. The Delta Conservancy informed the Delta ISB that it has released a final report on outcomes of the 2023 Delta Drought Response Pilot Program. So that's an experimental program that was launched to test drought-resistant field management practices in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta watershed. So that A copy of that report was included in your meeting package, since this has been an issue that's come up in our discussions before. We've received two public comments. So the Sierra Club California and a group of other public organizations has provided us with two comments, CC'd us basically on comments they've sent to others. One on the DWR's Department of Water Resources, DEIR for the long-term operations of the State Water Project. And then they also sent along additional comments sent to DWR on the draft EIR for the long-term operations of state water projects, focusing on impacts to threatened and endangered species. And we do appreciate getting that CC, and that's also in your meeting packet. Edmund, any public comments on this part of the agenda?
There are none.
All right, moving on to agenda item three then, election of the chair-elect. So the Delta ISB chairship consists of three positions, the chair-elect, and the past chair. And each position serves a total of 2 years, serves 2 years with a total of 6 years in the chairship. On September 1st, a short 2 weeks from now, Dr. Inga Werner will become the chair and I will become past chair. So we're looking forward to that transition. And so now we have an opening for the new chair-elect and we would like to take action today on that. So once elected, the new chair-elect's duties would begin September 1st, 2024. So I now open the floor for nominations. And I believe Inga has something she would like
I
to
do, say. And I'm looking for the raised hand, and I can't find it. Sorry.
That's okay, Inga. You just dive right in.
So here's my raised hand. I would like to nominate Dr. Diane McKnight. Dr. McKnight has a great deal of leadership experience and has been actively involved in two major Delta ISB reviews over the past 2 years. She helped plan and lead both the subsidence and the food webs reviews. Dr. McKnight's groundbreaking scientific work has significantly advanced our understanding of the interplay among climate, hydrology, water quality, and habitat in lakes, streams, and wetlands all over the world. Her holistic approach recognizes the interconnectedness of ecosystem components and the multifaceted drivers of change. So this is my nomination.
Well, thank you, Inga. So now I'll ask Dr. McKnight if she accepts this nomination.
Thank you very much, Inga. I am honored to accept the position of chair of the Delta.
Okay, wait, Diane. Wait, first you just accept the nomination.
Okay, I'm honored to accept the.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm honored to accept the nomination. Sorry, I'm.
That's okay. Just making sure we don't jump the gun here.
So. Okay, sorry.
No worries. No worries at all. So yes, I think this is an exciting nomination. And so now I'll ask, does the ISB have any comments on this nomination? Tom?
Yeah, I just want to say how much I've enjoyed working with Diane on the subsidence review, and her input and contributions are substantial in the report. So I wholeheartedly second the nomination.
You're very good, Anna.
And I'll just briefly say that I have also for many years now had a very high professional regard for Dr. McKnight. I have known of her work for probably at least a couple of decades now. And so her scientific record really brings a lot to this role. Where should she be confirmed in this role? And so I also very much support her nomination.
Thanks, Anna. Obey.
Yeah, I also support Diane's nomination. I felt like often she had a very broad knowledge of many subjects, including some of the engineering aspects that I'm interested in sometimes. So that will be very valuable to ISP. So I support the nomination.
All right, wonderful. Lots of support. Are there any public comments on the nominee?
There are none.
Okay, so at this point, I need a motion and a second to move forward with this nomination. So the motion would be to elect McKnight to become chair-elect. We have many hands. Mr. Tom, yeah.
I second the nomination to elect Diane the chairman-elect.
Okay, so we first need a thank you, Tom, for seconding. What Inga, maybe you should be the one to make the motion to nominate. You effectively made the motion to elect McKnight to become chair elect, right? Oh, you're muted, Inga.
Sorry. I move to make a motion. I make a motion to elect Diane McKnight to as the chair elect. So
very good. And then Tom seconds. Okay, so now we can move on to the vote. I think Robert is satisfied that we've done the right thing. So I'll do a roll call vote. Just say yay or nay. Virginia.
Yes.
Tanya.
Yes.
Tom.
Yes.
Anna.
Yes.
Diane.
Yes.
Bob.
Yes.
Obey. Obey, are you? Whoops.
Yes, I'm muted. I was muted.
You were
yes.
muted. Okay, sorry, I wasn't looking. I was looking at my list. And Inga.
Yes.
And I also vote yes. Okay, well, wonderful. Congratulations to Dr. McKnight on being elected chair unanimously. I just want to agree with all the comments that have been made and note that Dr. McKnight's expertise and vision will undoubtedly enhance the board's activities. And I think she's going to ensure a comprehensive and forward-thinking perspective as we move forward. And I think we're really fortunate to have her leadership as we navigate these complex socioecological challenges of the California Delta system. So let me turn it over to Diane now to say a few remarks.
Well, thank you very much, everyone, for your kind words. And I am honored to accept the position of chair elect of the Delta Independent Science Board. In this role, my plan is to carry forward the dedication of past chairs of the board to ensuring that the best available science is used throughout the decision-making process. By conducting thorough scientific reviews, we will continue to strive to provide accurate, reliable, and up-to-date information and analysis to guide our initiatives and recommendations. We will continue to identify topics for study through engagement with diverse stakeholders who are involved in the wide array of activities and management actions, and to provide timely assessments related to new developments. I look forward to collaborating with my esteemed colleagues to uphold the highest standards of scientific integrity and to support evidence-based solutions that address our most pressing environmental challenges. Together, we will work towards a sustainable and informed future for the Delta.
Thank you, Diane. We look forward to your leadership. So, okay, we'll now move on to the next agenda item. I'm glad that worked out so well. And agenda item number 4 is the Delta Stewardship Council Chair and Executive Officer Report. Are they here?
Hi, good morning. It's Julie.
Hi, Julie. Welcome. I don't see you on my screen. Oh, there you are. Okay.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm pleased to be here at another ISB meeting. I do have quite an extensive report out for you today. So just grab your coffee and hang on. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the report out on the Delta Plan 5-year review. We want to thank you for submitting comments on that draft. And the comments that you did submit during the meeting and provided in the letter were very useful to us in finalizing that 5-year review. One of the things that you'd asked for more clarity about was the progress on the priorities in the 2019 5-year review, and to also identify where progress was limited. So in response to that, the staff has added an overview table summarizing the status of the issues and actions identified in 2019. The ISB also suggested adding information describing how the proposed recommendations were selected, including making connections to efforts by other agencies to address the red performing areas that are outside of the council's sphere of influence. So we've added more details to that information as well. The ISB offered specific comments regarding implementation of some of the proposed recommendations. For example, accelerating ecosystem restoration obviously is a key council priority, and the Delta Plan ecosystem amendment regulations are wrapping up the rulemaking process and will become effective in 2025. We're actually dealing with that at our upcoming council meeting next week. Also, a DPIC restoration subcommittee has been established and hosted two public restoration forums and is addressing interagency coordination and permitting issues. Developing improved metrics for Delta socioeconomic changes is a proposed priority in the five-year review as well. The proposal was modified and refocused on data compilation and synthesis to provide a suite of socioeconomic indicators that can be displayed on the Council's performance measure dashboard. As our work progresses, staff may continue to reach out to the ISB for feedback on this work, particularly the proposed portfolio of economic metrics. Staff is also adding additional details, clarification, and methodology descriptions into the technical appendix of the five-year review in response to the Delta ISB's comments, including being clear and transparent regarding data limitations in cases where a simplified metric is used to evaluate a complex attribute of the system. And the example they gave was such as wild salmon abundance as a key metric for ecosystem outcomes, or sediment toxicity as metric for environmental water quality. Finally, the five-year review process identified opportunities for the performance measures to be improved, and the Council anticipates meeting the performance measures in the future and will use the comments from the ISB in that process as well. Council staff plans to present the five-year review in September to the Council for our endorsement. We also wanted to give you an update on subsidence review. We greatly look forward to hearing the review at discussion later today. And obviously, the Council also considers subsidence a major problem and intersects with all aspects of achieving the co-equal goals and the issues that we deal with in the Delta. As you well know, in a tidal environment, elevation influences what land uses are possible. Solutions to subsidence are complex and expensive, and the Delta ISB's review will be a critical step to informing solutions. Understanding areas that need further research will help the Delta Science Program with research priorities using the information from this review. Council staff are following the ISB's subsidence review and will use report findings to inform next steps for the five-year review. The five-year review recommends actions for the Council to coordinate activities for advancing carbon market incentives for carbon sequestration in rice farms and wetlands, providing funding to landowners to cover conversion costs for setting up rice production and wetlands, and focusing on outreach to farmers and landowners regarding benefits, opportunities, and permitting needs. Our forthcoming Delta ADAPTS adaptation plan includes several strategies that address the need to reverse or halt subsidence in the Delta. And we look forward to your comments on the draft Delta ADAPTS adaptation plan when it's released to ensure we can capture the information from the subsidence review in that as well. We also held a Science for Communities workshop on July 12th. This was a free hybrid workshop to showcase projects created by interdisciplinary partnerships between scientists, community-based organizations, and members of the public. The goal was for these partnerships to result in research that addresses social and environmental issues in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. The workshop included presentations, discussions, and networking opportunities, which helped build relationships and improved access to environmental data, promoted knowledge sharing and tools to meet community needs, and showcased internship opportunities and results from ongoing research projects. We had invited 6 community-based organizations and 18 research partners from academia, government, and private businesses. Those organizations represented included an organization called Little Manila Rising, which presented suggestions to improve a youth organizer's curriculum, which improved environmental literacy in diverse audiences. There was another organization called Restore the Delta, which partnered with staff from the Shingle Springs Band of the Miwok Indians. They presented indicators and signs of harmful algal blooms to inform actions that tribes and Delta communities can take to stay safe. We also heard from the California Indian Environmental Alliance, who presented guidance for the safe consumption of wild fish and discussed the impacts of contaminants on tribes and the community. The Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness presented about emergency housing available in Delta Legacy communities which have been impacted by flooding. The Strategic Growth Council, which is another state agency, presented on capacity building and technical assistance available to communities to get project ideas off the ground and acquire funding. And finally, the Delta Science Program presented on science funding processes. The event was very successful. We had 125 attendees that plugged in either online or in person. And we believe that it was positively received. And we have a recording of it available on the council's YouTube channel if you're interested in watching on any of those topics. And finally, I'm going to go ahead and take the opportunity now, although I am planning to stay on for the duration of this meeting. I just wanted to share my reflections on Dr. Wenger's term here as the ISB chair. Never know what's going to happen between now and the end of a meeting, and I'd hate to not to miss the opportunity to give her some kudos. Just on a personal level, I've really enjoyed getting to know Lisa, and I'm glad that she'll be staying on the ISB. Just being the new chair and coming in and having to kind of get caught up on things, I really appreciate the plain language and easy way that she explains a very complex scientific information to those of us that are not scientists. So keep that in mind, Inga, as you fill her shoes, please, for me. I also want to give our congratulations for Inga as incoming chair and Diane McKnight as chair-elect. So that's exciting news. On behalf of the whole council, I want to extend our gratitude to Dr. Wenger for her outstanding service as the chair, and we look forward to collaborating with her in her new role as the past chair. Dr. Wenger made sure diverse voices were heard at ISB meetings and welcomed discussions on complex topics. So those were sentiments from other staff that wanted to make sure that everyone heard our congratulations and thanks to Dr. Wenger. So that wraps up my report.
Well, thank you, Julie, and thanks for passing along those kind words. We'll just check to see if there are any public comments on this report. Edmund, do we have any public?
Yes, we have a public comment. We have one from Deirdre Desjardins. Deirdre, you have the ability to unmute your microphone.
Thank you. Deirdre Desjardins with California Water Research and Climate Action California. And I just wanted to thank Lisa Wenger for stepping up and being chair of the Delta Independent Science Board at a moment of crisis in the Delta Science Board's existence. And she's led it amazingly and brought people together. It was an act of courage, and I continue to be profoundly grateful to all the Delta Independent Science Board members who stayed on when the board was defunded in 2020 to 2021. But it was an act of exceptional public service, and with Lisa's vision and experience in Chesapeake Bay, I think the board is on just a much, much better footing going forward. And I think it's incredibly important in this time of accelerating climate change. So on behalf of all of the stakeholders that I worked with who supported the Delta Independent Science Board, I just want to extend our most profound gratitude for Dr. Wenger's service as chair. Thank you.
Well, you're all too kind to this environmental economist who I know many fields view with some suspicion. So I do appreciate the kind words. And I've really enjoyed working with the folks who've spoken. Julie and Deirdre both make important contributions to this science enterprise. And I appreciate the good words. from people I respect. So with that, do we have, is that all our comments?
Yeah, no additional public comments.
Okay, great. So then we can move on to our next agenda item where finally I get to hand off to somebody soon. Agenda item 5 is discussion of the Food Webs review. So Bob, you'll be up in a second after I give a little background. So the Delta ISB recently received public comments on its draft review, exploring scientific and management implications of upper trophic level food webs in the Delta. This draft was based on a review of the literature on the subject, public comments on the prospectus, and of course, conversations at Delta ISB meetings and a focused 2-day workshop. The goal of this review is to provide information that would help organizations, including state and federal agencies, assess how to better incorporate and advance food web knowledge, particularly of upper trophic levels, in managing the Delta's ecosystems and to identify what tools are available or possibly should be developed. So now I'll ask Bob to give us a status update and let us know where things are at.
Well, thank you, Lisa, for giving the preamble to that. Concerning the Food Web report, I think we're in very good shape. I cannot recall how much I told you at our last virtual meeting, but we did receive numerous comments, very germane comments from both organizations as well as individuals. And I compiled all of the comments into a table and then tried to cross-link our responses to the individual comments. It's a very lengthy table. It's about 27 pages long or so. It's perhaps reflecting the diversity and breadth and of all the comments. We were able to respond to probably somewhere between 95 and 99% of the comments in a positive way. We incorporated them into the report. And collectively, I think that all the comments made it a much, much stronger report and a more inclusive report. So anyway, there were a few comments, however, that I didn't feel that I had the expertise to respond to. So I asked Kenny Rose to help me with those, mostly around the modeling and some of the wording about how we would describe the modeling. And Kenny gave us suggestions on how to proceed on all of those, as well as providing some additional editing, to the edits that I and others had made. And I have that in hand now. I think it'll take probably a day to, or maybe a couple of days, to finalize the report, which I hope to do by next Tuesday or Wednesday. And then I will send it to Edmund for editing and putting it in the proper format by the staff. So it should be in your hands to review in plenty of time before our next meeting. And at the next meeting, I guess we will decide then, I assume we will decide on whether we go to publication or whether it needs additional edits. So anyway, that's an update on the report. In terms of the activity itself, it has been accepted for a presentation at the Bay Delta Conference at the end of September, early October, I guess. And so, based on the comments we received and the revisions of the report, I'll be revising the presentation slightly to make sure that any pertinent changes, have been made and will be presented to the public and to our colleagues at that time. So do we have any comments on what I said, or if there's something that I missed that I should be speaking to? Tom?
Yeah, I'm just curious how you handled the comment about the animals above the fish level. I don't know what it's formally called, but remember that was raised as a concern.
Yeah, I think what Tom, what you're referring to is that the original title and the focus was really on the upper trophic levels in the delta, and yet the report and the activity evolved over time to be perhaps with a strong focus on the upper trophic levels. But in order to do that, we needed to bring a lot of background in on other trophic levels, especially detritus and some of the I don't know, quote, lower trophic levels below the fish. So we handled that by changing the title slightly, by if I remember correctly, taking out the emphasis on the upper trophic levels out of the main title, and then putting it in the subtitle, as that there wasn't there. Overall, the report is an emphasis on the upper trophic levels, but the main title of the report will have to do with the trophic dynamics of the delta itself. And then in the text, that was handled in several different ways to say that in order to really understand what was going on with the upper trophic levels, especially the fishes, we really needed to discuss and understand better some of the trophic pathways that in the past had not been thoroughly researched or understood, and that we were recommending to the community that more emphasis be placed on these particular trophic pathways, especially as to how they would impact the predatory fishes and other predators in the system.
Sounds good.
So, Tom, anyway, I hope that was kind of a long answer, but it's a complicated topic.
No, it was a serious concern of some of the commenters. I was just curious.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Well, sounds like everyone's at least thrilled so far. So, anyway, I will try to get this, try my very best to get this to Edmund by next Wednesday, and then we will edit it and we will have it in your hands. I'm not sure how long it'll take Edmund and the staff to get it ready for you to look at, but I would imagine they'll need a couple of weeks. So perhaps look for something in your as an email, probably towards the middle of September. Edmund, are there any public comments?
Yes, we have one from Deirdre Dejardin. Deirdre, you have the ability to unmute your microphone. Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank Bob for all of his efforts on the Food Web Review. And it's just, again, I really appreciate your knowledge and experience of ecosystems. And this is just an incredibly critical time for the Delta. So thank you again from all of us.
Great. Thanks, Deirdre. Really appreciate you and what you've had to say. So thank you very much. Other comments, public comments, Edmund?
No additional public comments. Thank you.
Okay. I guess Lisa, the gavel's back to
Thanks. Thanks, Bob. And I just want to echo what Deirdre brought up too, that you really have been putting in a lot of time and effort on this, and we do appreciate that you somewhat inherited this. I know you were part of the original group, but maybe there were other people around doing things for a while, but you've really shouldered a lot of the effort, as and then Kenny Rose has done quite a bit too. So we really appreciate you digging into all these issues and being responsive. So okay, moving on to agenda item number six, a discussion of decision making under deep uncertainty review. So I'll give a bit of background, and then we have a presentation by Shoko Shinbrat. So the purpose of this review was to build an understanding of the scientific tools and concepts that can increase the capacity to anticipate and adapt to the growing uncertainty of future conditions in the Bay Delta system. And our review had two main components: a seminar series, you all participated in that, and an inventory and analysis of how scenarios are being used in the Delta region and with an eye toward how uncertainty is being addressed. And Kyra Wallace, the previous ISB fellow, has prepared a draft summary of this seminar series with help from ISB members. And we're hoping to have that released before the Bay Delta Science Conference at the end of September. And then Shoko Shinbrot and Margo Mattson and other team members have completed interviews with scenario developers. So this is that second inventory product. And they're finishing up those interviews, which complemented a kind of a lit review of reports about these scenario elements. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Shoko Shinbrot to share highlights from those interviews. Take it away.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. Good to be here. Again, my name is Shoko Shinbrot. I'm a senior environmental scientist in the adaptive management unit, and I'm serving as part of the ISB support staff for this decision-making under deep uncertainty review. And I'll be, like Lisa said, presenting initial results from interviews as a result of these efforts, together with Sea Grant fellow Margo Mattson and previous ISB postdoc Lillian McCormick. Next slide. Thank you. Just a brief overview. I'll be providing an introduction to the topic, a review of the overall purpose, diving into how we did our work, and then kind of the two-pronged results of interviews with scenario developers and scenario users. And then talking a little bit about takeaways and where do we go from here. Next slide. So just to introduce you a little bit to the idea of uncertainty. So individuals, just like agencies, face uncertainties every day. Obviously, you know, individuals have to make decisions about regular old uncertainties, like whether to wear a rain jacket, to more impactful decisions like whether to purchase flood or earthquake insurance. And then so obviously for agencies, it's these hard to predict conditions, which are becoming more common with climate change, that challenge effective management in the Bay Delta and may force them to prioritize some goals over others. So it's by, you know, building up this understanding of the tools and the scenarios of how these range of uncertainties may unfold that we can really better prepare for and adapt to unprecedented extremes. Next slide. So with this kind of in mind, the ISB was interested in investigating the development and the application of scenarios to address both uncertainty and deep uncertainty in the Delta, and using this kind of two-pronged approach where phase one was an inventory of understanding the design and the development of scenarios to understand uncertainty and deep uncertainty. And then phase two was interviews focused on how scenarios are applied in decision support in the Bay Delta. And it's this second phase that I'm really going to be doing a deep dive in today. Next slide. But before we get into it, I, you know, wanted to do a brief refresher for those that may be new to the topic of what is DMDU. So as you might remember, deep uncertainty, part of the DMDU, occurs when parties don't really know or agree on likelihood of alternative futures or how actions are related to consequences. So these kinds of uncertainties tend to be underestimated and are really typified by these compounding or catastrophic events. You could think of an earthquake as setting off a cascade of levee failures across the Delta as kind of one of those. Of course, there's this wide range of how to understand, or excuse me, of how uncertain futures are understood. The range is well demonstrated in the figure to the right, which is taken from Cork et al. And then kind of simplified for this image, where the black line in the center and the cone represent these projected futures. And there's often this implicit assumption that these are maybe the most desirable uncertainties to understand. But extending that cone into alternative futures to the, you know, the widest cone, these deeply uncertain futures, can really help understanders plan for extreme black swan events. So how do decision makers deal with deep uncertainty? So the DM part of it, decision makers. So luckily there are a number of strategies, a few select ones are shown here. So decision makers can build adaptive pathways to try and reduce vulnerabilities. They can engage in stress testing. You know, at their core, deep uncertainty often engages in this scenario analysis to envision possible futures. And if you are interested in any of these and learning more, I am making a plug for you to check out the DMDU seminar series, which is available on our YouTube channel. Next slide. So getting back to, you know, the phase one and phase two questions. So the phase one inventory that was built out from the scenarios that were submitted during a public comment period to the ISB, and then a team-based review of the 18 scenarios from 2017 onward were then assessed. And those kind of reflected the most recent scenarios. You can go to the next slide. And in phase two, we did these semi-structured interviews with the lead authors of these 18 scenarios, what we call the scenario developers, to fill gaps not found in the articles. So, and the interview questions were iteratively and collaboratively designed with members of the ISB. And then in a snowball sampling strategy, we asked the scenario developers to identify scenario users or potential users. Next slide. And as a refresher, the inventory, like I said, contained these 18 scenarios, and they're listed here. They ranged from everything from Arc Storm to D-List to Frank's Track Futures and others in the Delta. Next slide. So in case you forgot, we put together a little refresher as on what we found during the inventory. I know it's been a few months since I presented. So first, we found that scenarios really covered this wide range of topics, which you can see in the world word cloud to the right. As you can see, water was a major concern, specifically water supply and water quality. But we also saw strong interest in understanding future ecological conditions as climate change progressed, as well as impacts on land use. Next slide. We also found that most scenarios considered either projected or probable futures. So indeed, only two really considered plausible futures, considering extreme events, and none were in this, you know, widest cone, what some people call preposterous, but the deeply uncertain futures. So that said, the best practices for modeling uncertainty were becoming more frequent. So agencies and academics frequently identified trade-offs, updated historic data, integrated adaptive behaviors, and are paying attention to stress testing and decision scaling as emerging methods. Next slide. So finally, we found the inventory seemed to reveal that relatively few scenarios, aside from Frank's tracked futures, leaned into the participatory methods to help overcome cognitive bias, using any kind of qualitative data or non-traditional methods. But the interviews actually revealed something quite different, which is great, and I'll be discussing that very soon. Next slide. But before I do, I just wanted to give you a sense of where we are in the timeline. So we launched the DMDU seminar series in June of 2023. The prospectus for research, oh, that's go back, sorry, was finalized in August, and then the inventory of scenarios was finished just 6 months later. And the interviews, which I'm presenting now, 6 months after that, which I'm about to present on. So next slide. So what did we find from interviews with scenario developers as part of phase two? Well, we covered 13 scenarios during interviews with 19 developers, mostly academics and agency staff. The scenarios covered can be seen on the right. And again, these interviews are used to supplement the inventory. Next slide. So we asked four broad types of questions related to unexplored uncertainty on participation, expanded participation beyond the authors, on who are the users, how are they communicated, and how are they used for policy or decision support, and then finally, the lessons learned. Next slide. Oh, yeah, okay. That previous slide. Sorry. We're going to be focusing on the three that are highlighted here, and focusing on the user results later on just due to time constraints. So, okay. Next slide. Perfect. Okay, so since we knew from the scenarios what uncertainties were included, we were interested to learn a little bit more about areas of uncertainty that were not included. So these were questions that we asked of what types of uncertainties are not included in scenario development. So this gave us an idea of what are the potential blind spots. And we found a range of different uncertainties that were not included. This included levee stability, which was discussed by six individuals, economics or policy, which included carbon markets or crop pricing, that was discussed by five individuals. And then five individuals discussed how they did not include sea level rise. Either it was not included at all, or they only considered up to like 1, 1.5, or 2 feet. So, next slide to give you a little flavor of what we heard. So, one interviewee said a good example of that uncertainty that we didn't account for is fragility curves for levee stability. And we just don't have the data. Normally, engineers will take borings every 100 feet to make a soil profile, but we don't have those. And another interviewee said, this question came up several times. Why aren't you considering policies on the SGMA or the State Groundwater Management Act? And we intentionally decided not to do that because things related to SGMA implementation are still in a state of flux. So again, it's important to note, sorry, that these uncertainties were identified by the scenario developers. So of course, there are going to be blind spots that they might not have considered, which is why, again, it's important to consider to include participation of various parties in the process to kind of identify some blind spots. So speaking of participation, we asked the designers who else was included in scenario development, and we found most groups had a considerable amount of participation, which is an about face from what we found in the inventory, which is great. So, for example, one interviewee said, you can advance the slide. I would just say how important the co-design is, really having people who are impacted by the scenario development, and there's something more generative about that and more buy-in and learning that happens. Another interviewee who had kind of a moderate level of participation, sometimes provided informally as input, said, in this project, we got a lot of input while doing the project through informal meetings and throughout the process. And then finally, two scenario designers said they had relatively little amount of input, with one person saying, if you have a good team of scientists who already have stakeholder connections and understanding of the stakeholders, that's key. So, next slide. So, what were some lessons learned that scenario designers identified? Well, many designers brought up participatory processes, how bringing together diverse audiences and expertise is critical for uptake. Although two recognize the importance of having safe spaces for group discussions. Next. Next slide, sorry. Oh, perfect. Some interviewees brought up themes about uncertainty. So tools like decision scaling have really changed the trajectory of work on risk. And just highlighting how communicating uncertainty and complexity is remains a challenge. One individual talked about needing to expand research into monetary impacts on water supply or running a do-nothing scenario against other scenarios. And then next slide. Several individuals talked about some of the challenges to using DMDU in policymaking. Talking about how research needs to happen at the right time and scale for policy uptake. Difficulties in how policymakers define risk and the state inflexibility and bureaucracy, which are often not aligned in DMDU. And these are all themes that you will see in the scenario user interviews as well. So next slide. So thinking about, what did the users or potential users think? We covered 10 scenarios during the interviews with 13 scenario users or potential users. These were mostly agency staff. And the scenarios covered and the organizations can be seen on the right. Slide. We asked questions related to kind of three major themes: usability, excuse me, familiarity with the scenarios, usability, or potential improvements. But other topics came up during the interviews, like barriers to use, which I'll present later on. Next slide. So, how did users learn about the results? Well, most of them were actually contributors to the scenarios or funders of the project. So, we only interviewed one pure user. So, in other words, the scenario users are more likely to use them if they are engaged in the process, which was interesting to us. Next slide. So how are they being used? Well, the interviews provided insights on the use of scenarios and tools. So for example, four users said they used the scenarios to inform prioritizations and investments or recommendations. One of the interviewees said, with decision scaling of understanding, we can understand capabilities of both the existing and planned investments And how does that shape the vulnerability space based on what decisions you make in the prioritizations and investment in the plan? Next slide. But individuals and, you know, scenario users often use these to communicate to individuals and local governments. Where one scenario user said, you can run tabletop exercises, interactive workshops to help people explore the space, going from an extreme events to compounding events. Next slide. So we also asked how scenarios should potentially be modified. And we found that three individuals said that scenarios should consider state and local priorities. So for instance, this one user said, to us, it would have made more sense if you pay attention to things that are important to the state. For instance, we could see that each island has levies and those has levies that are in the conveyance path. Those levies should absolutely be a priority for the state to keep in good shape. Next slide. And then we also found two who identified that scenarios should include financial risk and action. This was also identified by the scenario developers. So this one individual said, we want to know this: what future atmospheric rivers will do to the number and size of financial losses that are in a community. And that's in part because one of the roles of our department plays is that we do provide technical assistance to local governments in the state who reach out to us and say, well, how much insurance is there in within this area? Next slide. So we did find some who aren't or aren't yet using some of the scenarios. One of the reasons that came up is that it just takes time. You know, we chose scenarios from 2017 onwards. And so some of these were very recently published. So this one individual said, water plan data often has a bit of a slow burn. It takes a while before recommendations and data make its way into either legislation or local agency initiatives. Next slide. There's also some, at times, a mismatch in timelines. One individual said, an insurance policy is generally written for 1 year, whereas you're probably thinking about 20 to 30 year or 50 year timelines in DMDU. Next slide. Six individuals talked about the lack of funding or lack of capacity. So one person said, the amount of people with the skill sets to do these kinds of analyses is a challenge because this kind of analysis with a lot of data, they can't be done with traditional techniques, and people that have those skill sets are less common. Next slide. Unfortunately, there's also a knowledge gap, particularly by those that are not necessarily the scenario developers. So these are include managers on, you know, what is DMDU? So one person said, I don't have quite enough exposure yet to really understand the utility of DMDU. And next slide. And finally, some people perceived DMDU to be outside of their agency or organization scope. So this one person said, I have a feeling, and again, it's a feeling since I'm not a policy person, that DMDU is just outside our scope. Phew. Okay. That was a lot. So getting back to the original purpose of this review, which is to investigate whether and how scenarios are being developed and applied in the Delta. Next slide. So getting at this question of scenario development, we found a number of uncertainties that aren't currently being considered or captured. And these include levy stability as well as financial or policy considerations. These types of uncertainties we often lack good data on, or they change so quickly that it's really hard to predict impact. We found that scenario developers are using participatory methods more frequently than expected from the inventory, which is great for overcoming cognitive biases, but few are really using novel ways at getting at revealed preferences using methods like games or simulations. Next slide. In terms of the application side of DMDU, it's really a mixed bag on how frequently they're being used, in part because there are a number of barriers for use, particularly lack of funding or capacity came up, and then there's still some misunderstanding of what DMDU really is. Finally, we found that uncertainty is not systematically evaluated or applied across agencies and scenarios. Indeed, there are really no policies or procedures by which agencies can easily advance uncertainty, let alone deep uncertainty. Next slide. And with that, I just wanted to leave you with where we are in the process. So again, finished our interviews. In fall, we'll be completing our seminar synthesis. October 2nd, if you're going to the Bay Delta Science Conference, come see us. We'll be having a DMDU discussion where the ISB will pre be presenting their recommendations. And then in winter, we hope to have a draft inventory and interview findings and recommendations drafted. And with that, I will pause and take any questions.
That was fantastic, Shoko. Thank you so much to you, Margot, and Lillian for that really nice synthesis. I think you've pulled out some important, I particularly like the sort of why isn't DMDU being used, or I forget exactly what that slide was called, but I think those quotes are really relevant. And I just want to remind folks that we're not saying DMDU is the answer to every problem and everyone has to use it. So I think another way to look at those things is to really think about where does it fit best, to try to overcome some of the impediments when it is a good fit, and or when agencies might need to be pushed a little bit to be more forward-looking than they currently are. So I think these are interesting questions we want to consider. So, and then I'll turn it over to people who've actually raised their hands, Tanya.
Oh, thanks. First of all, Shoko, really great job summarizing what you all have found with these interviews and reminding us also of the inventory findings. And this was really helpful, I think, for us to kind of start to get a big picture, but also some of the details of what we're learning. And so I have two questions, and one is a more detailed question, and the other is more about big picture. In terms of the detailed question, you mentioned from the findings from the interviews with scenario developers that decision scaling has changed the trajectory of work on risk, and you didn't have time to get into that. So I'd love to hear you if you have any thoughts on that point. I'd love to hear you expand just a little bit on kind of what you're finding there. I think that could be potentially interesting. And then the broader question is really, when we started this DMDU effort, I think we were initially kind of going to really stick to this kind of more strict definition of DMDU. And then as we started kind of looking at what's being done, we started exploring, well, there's tools that are used in DMDU like scenarios, and they often aren't used to look at deep uncertainty, but they may be looking at a range of uncertainties. And we're finding that there's kind of this broader spectrum of use of tools like scenarios or stakeholder engagement processes or decision scaling and things like that. So I guess the question for you is, what do you think we as the board need to consider when we're doing this report in terms of how we frame the focus of this report? Like, should we be thinking more broadly about this broader spectrum of tools for assessing uncertainty, broadly speaking, or should we really be more narrowly focused on these DMDU questions? So Hope those two questions make sense.
Yeah, well, I will welcome input also from other members of the board on that second question. And just starting with the decision scaling and how that's kind of changed the whole direction of DMDU. That came up actually a few times. So I think Andrew Schwartz was one of the first individuals to kind of apply decision scaling at an individually, and then people working on the state water plan actually brought up, after we interviewed him, how important understanding and using those tools were, and just how it's just really showing the broad range of uncertainties in a way that they had never kind of thought about. And again, having the people who are able to actually run those kinds of analyses is still a barrier, because there are only a few, who are able to. And I think one of the people said, that, and it's difficult to be able to communicate it. They said that, the traditional ways in which some of the, information is communicated, you think about like Excel tables. He said that from decision scaling, there were 36,000 tables that were produced. And so it then becomes this challenge of like, well, we have all of this information, and like, how do we communicate it in a way that leads to effective outcomes? So so it came up a few times of just how it's kind of transformed the way that some agencies are kind of getting at uncertainty. And then the
Can I, before you move on, can I just
yeah, go
ask you
ahead.
one follow-up to that? That was a great answer, but I also am just curious, like, did they overcome the communication challenge to a degree that allowed the information to be used, or are they kind of stuck in that place, is my question.
I think it continues to be a challenge. I mean, I think inherently the social scientists know that people tend to avoid uncertainty at any cost. Most people try not to, or to reduce uncertainty. And so really being able to talk about deep uncertainty, let alone just regular uncertainty, it is still a challenge. And then having that translate into prioritizations, it seems to me like that continues to be a challenge.
And just, I'm sorry, I think this is the decision support side of DMDU that has a place too, because yeah, it is true that a lot of technical people can characterize uncertainty, but then they don't know what to do with it. And so there are tools in DMDU to help users. So I just wanted to leave it there. And now you can finish your answer.
That's a good point. Yeah, there are tools out there. The inventory actually had only a few tools where, individuals could kind of play around with like different, for instance, climate change scenarios. And so there's still kind of a gap in that communication that could be filled. And then in terms of your second question about what the board should consider moving forward, I think there's still so much data that I'm still working through that reflection myself. More to come there, but I welcome any other board members who wanted to jump in and saw certain things of interest. So, yeah.
Okay, why don't we keep going with comments, and then should feel free to comment on that if they have thoughts. Bob?
Yeah.
Well, Shilko, thank you for the very nice presentation, a very nice overview. I do have two questions. First of all, your sample size to me seems quite small. And I was wondering how representative you thought your sampling was of the overall community acceptance of DMDU.
So the 18 scenarios, that was just generated from the call, public call for scenarios or, you know, plans. So we were somewhat constrained by, you know, what we got. So, and then we constrained it even more because it's like, well, we're not going to be looking at things that, you know, were made in the early 2000s, which are maybe not so much informing things now. How representative is it? I think that it's a good slice of what is happening. You know, things like ArcStorm are really changing the face of how people are considering atmospheric rivers. Sorry, I just had a brain fart. But clearly, you know, it would be great if we could do just a systematic review of every single scenario that was produced in the Delta. But I also think that this is, you know, DMDU is still relatively new, so we're a little constrained in that way too.
Yeah, so it's really kind of querying you about, you know, the people that responded. It didn't seem like there was a lot of individual or institutional responses. And so I really wondered how representative that would be in terms statistically. Is it biased or unbiased, or does it reflect what's going on out there?
It's a good point. We had 18 scenarios. We interviewed, I think, 13 developers, and then it's those 13 developers that then gave us names of, you know, the potential users. We are constrained by who responded, who wanted to talk to us. I don't know that I have a good response, but we got as much as we could, I guess.
Well, and can I just add, with qualitative interviews, Bob, the goal is not always, it's not necessarily to have statistically representative samples. With qualitative interviews, we're looking for in-depth knowledge that reflects the broad spectrum of knowledge that's in the Delta here, but we're not trying to put together a representative sample of individuals who might be experienced with this.
Okay. Well,
one other clarifying point, we weren't trying to characterize all responses to DMDU. It was more just of people doing scenario analysis. What had they incorporated? How had they incorporated uncertainty? So again, it wasn't meant to be every.
We're starting with a very small population, as Shoko said, based on what scenarios we had available that were relatively recent.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. That was understood. I have a second question, and that has to do with the takeaways. Were you surprised by any of the takeaways, or are they takeaways that you already knew? Did you learn anything from the takeaways by the ones at least the ones you articulated?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised, when we went into the inventory, there were only a few that really talked about their participatory methods. And so we went into the interviews thinking that most of the scenario designers did not have any kind of participation. And so I was really surprised and happy to see, you know, that they are using participatory methods. That doesn't mean that they're actually putting it in the document, because of course the inventory is just like, you know, reading through a document. So it might not have how many public comment periods or how many workshops or how many technical advisory committees. And so that was a, happy surprise for me. Other Yeah, I guess I also went in thinking that almost no one was kind of thinking about deep uncertainty, and it's really been a happy just surprise to see the amount of interest in DMDU. Particularly from certain agencies like DWR, just really leaning into the, cutting edge of how do we do this in the most effective way possible to reduce uncertainty, to reduce losses, and to adapt to change when, these events occur. So, yeah, those are kind of two surprises that I found. Thanks
No,
for the
that's great.
feedback.
Good. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Obi.
Yeah, thank you, Shoko. I think it's a nice presentation, summarizing work to date and also the interview summary. So I have a few comments, based on what I just heard. One thing, my experience is that, there aren't very many examples worldwide of these large-scale systems of analyzing DMDU in the context of planning. And I think it's an emerging topic. What I hear both nationally and even internationally, this is an area of a lot of interest because of climate change. So in fact, I'm not worried too much about the sample size because I realized going into this, we may not have a lot of examples in Bay Delta, but in fact, I'm surprised we have, that many of them that we were able to dig up. I don't know if we will get any much more than that of significance to us. The other comment is I'm also not too worried about this large number of scenarios being analyzed and, decision scaling people have a way to deal with that. You look at a threshold, what scenarios make, are important to you if it exceeds a certain threshold, whether it's fish or water or hydrology or whatever, right? So I think that is, so my question is, my thinking is that maybe the summary reflects the fact that maybe there's not enough capacity for people to deal with this subject in the agencies, and that's very common across in other places. So my question is, do you think this systematic approach that we observed, a lack of it, will it provide the capacity for the scenario developers and scenario users to look at all these aspects that we are discussing?
Yeah, I think that your takeaways were kind of my takeaways, that there's not enough capacity for people to deal with, deep uncertainty, and that having some systematized approach where appropriate would be great. Particularly for those, I think the other thing is providing kind of proof of concept for some of the agencies. You may remember that there was one quote where someone said that they didn't think that deep uncertainty was really part of the scope of their agency. And so, kind of, the more that we show that like these tools are useful for adapting to change, and especially stress testing systems, so that we know what to do if the unimaginable comes to pass. I think that that's really important, and yeah, I guess I just agree with you, Obey.
Thanks, Diane. Oh, sorry, Obey, did you want to follow up?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
We'll have more time for discussion on this when we work on the report. Go ahead.
Well, I want to echo people's comments. A great presentation. And I have two comments. One, I was trying to read the list of agencies quickly on your slides. In the report going forward, it might be helpful to show that these were agencies responsible for the Delta smelt and reservoirs and quite a range of activities. I mean, you could even do this potentially graphically, with a picture of a fish or a picture of something to really get the sense that the breadth of responsibilities that were represented, at least, and then also the breadth of how different the bad outcomes are. In the case of the Delta smelt, the bad outcome is that all this effort that we've learned about over the last 2 years will be for naught because of something that happens. And or the reservoir issue, the manage water management, the bad outcome that everybody's got in the back of their minds is the water becomes too saline to be used in Southern California. We don't, the details will give nuance and help people understand what you're talking about. So that was one comment. And then I was really struck about the levee stability as being the top uncertainty that was not considered. And there's, in some ways, the levee stability is a cascade. Did they not consider how sea level rise would undermine levee stability? Did they not consider how an earthquake would take them all out? Did they not consider continued subsidence or the so it seems like the levee stability is almost a focus point for these other really uncertain events. Is that Was that your sense in talking to people, or I saw the quote was just about not having some soil measurements every 100 feet, and it seems there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I would not say that people necessarily would link like levee stability, and then that was like, the way that you just conceptualized it of like a cascading effect of like earthquakes and subsidence, and it's just like these are a few of the things. I mean, you did point out sea level rise, and that was something that several people said that they did not include, or they only included like a foot of sea level rise. But obviously, all of these things, or not all of them, but they're interconnected. So, yeah, and again, the uncertainties that are not covered, these are things that, the interviewee identified. So that doesn't mean that there aren't other ones that they didn't consider. It's just like the ones that are at the top of their mind that they know are important. It's like everyone considers levee stability and knows that it's important. But like you said, there is this cascade of other impacts, especially if you don't get levee stability right. There are other
Well, is this potentially an area where some combined effort to come up with a way to consider levee stability uncertainty that could then be used by multiple agencies in terms of heading towards a recommendation? See what I mean? Yeah. Anyway, I just want to, again, great presentation.
No, it's a good point. And something for the ISB to consider. Obviously, there's the D list, the for levies that is being used by some. So there are tools out there. So anyways, yeah, good point, something to consider.
Okay, Virginia, and then we'll go to public comments after Virginia.
I wanted to thank Diane for that comment, and also thank you to Joho and the others for a great presentation. My comment follows on what Diane said because it's clear that you presented open-ended questions and got the response. And I'm wondering if you presented a list of potential factors that weren't included and things like that to your open-ended questions, or even talked about the process a little bit more, like Diane was doing, if you think you might have gotten different results, or if this is an area that needs to be investigated further.
Sorry, if I if we had so there were interviews, so it's necessarily all open-ended. I guess I could have done like a ranking question of like which of these five were, least considered or something, which we did not do.
Well, right. I understand your methodology, and I'm kind of asking you to speculate.
Well, Shoko, remember that in the inventory process, there was a more systematic look at what was included and what wasn't, right?
That's true. I mean, we looked at the stressors and kind of the outcomes of those. So we could kind of, we did not dive into what isn't in the report, but we obviously have the scenarios, so we could do that. And it's something to consider as we're building out the uncertainties that are not considered, because the ones that people identify, these are the known blind spots, but then there are obviously unknown blind spots. So for instance, like five individuals identified like policy or economics as being unknowns that were not included within their reports or scenarios. But I would say many, if not most of them, did not include, economics in within it or policies. So, and again, that's because those kinds of things just like change so quickly, or in this state of flux, like the interviewee said. Yeah, it's a interesting question that we might need to deep dive into more. Thanks, Virginia. And I welcome any other responses to that question or others.
Well, I'd like to give our, we have a public comment. I'd like to go to that now, but yeah, I think this is a discussion to continue and appreciate Virginia raising that.
Yes, we have two public comments. We'll go in the order that I call your name. First be Gilbert Cosio and then Deirdre Desjardins. Gilbert, you have the ability to unmute your microphone. Thank you.
Thanks. Good morning, everybody. This is Gilbert Cosio, River Delta Consulting. I've been an engineering consultant in Delta Levees for about 40 years. And I just want to make one comment. First of all, Joko, that was a great presentation. I've been watching this deep uncertainty discussions that you guys have been having, and I really understood a lot better after your presentation. But one thing I wanted to add is the value of collaboration. Now, I know scientists go off and do things, and sometimes you never really bounce some of that high-level science off some of the locals or other experts that might be in the area. And I think it would help you a lot. In fact, I remember a time when I was on a committee during the CalFed days, a seismic subcommittee of CalFed, Levees and Channels Group. Chris Nudeck and I were named to the committee, and we didn't know anything about seismicity. But we had Norm Abramson and Ray Seed and Les Harder, experts in this sort of thing, seismicity and levees. And I remember sitting in those meetings, and Chris and I, our heads were just spinning because these, very intelligent people and knowledgeable on seismicity were just talking about things we had no clue about, until they asked us, "What do you think this levee is made out of?" And we told them, because that's what we know. We know what those levees are made out of. And it just blew them away that, oh, that's the key we needed. Now we can make this assumption and that assumption because we know it's got this much sand or this much peat. And so that's one of the things you might want to think about, is how do you bring the right people together to lower that uncertainty? Maybe it won't be deep, it'll be less deep, but still it'll be something that'll hone you in on the more realistic number. Another example, I was on a committee a few years ago with some all the high level deputy directors from DWR and Fish and Wildlife and whatnot. And I remember one of the other local stakeholder members said something like, "We don't know much, but what we know can help people a lot." So I just wanted to throw that in, that maybe some collaboration on some of these things would help. Like the levee stability, I could understand why that came up as a topic of uncertainty, because we need to know more about levee stability. On the other hand, those of us that have been out there for a long time know that looking at the peat maps and knowing how some of our levee stability geotechnical studies have gone, we can make pretty good guesses. And so, yeah, we don't know everything. And certainly risk assessment, getting borings 100, every 100 feet is not going to happen. We've tried to price that out before, and it's like $200,000 a mile, and it just doesn't pan out financially. So anyway, there's just a lot of local knowledge that if the scientists and practitioners can get together, I think you can really lower that uncertainty. Thank you.
I'll just quickly say while we're transitioning to the next public comment that, yeah, I think that, you know, this element of systematically gathering expert judgment can be a real way to fill some science gaps, particularly in the short term, if more analyses can be funded. So thank you for that comment.
Thank you. Yeah, good comment.
All right, Deirdre, you have the ability to unmute your microphone now. Thank you.
Yeah. Deirdre Desjardins, California Water Research and Climate Action, California. I did want to point out, so because the Delta ISB only looked at regional climate adaptation efforts in the Delta, they're not actually using the current state of the art in climate science. So this isn't really a review of decision-making under deep uncertainty, but decision-making under global climate model uncertainty. That is the sixth and fifth coupled model, Interconteras and project models. So the World Meteorological Organization is coordinating CMIP-7, and they're looking at modeling tipping point scenarios. There's new analyses that have come out showing that the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation could tip as soon as mid-century. And it's likely that the Delta Tunnel, for example, will be operating there. There is modeling that shows that would profoundly reorganize global atmospheric circulation as well as the Atlantic deep ocean overturning circulation. And it could result in permanent La Nina-like conditions in the Pacific Ocean. There's modeling that shows that, and it would be a mega drought. So the seventh coupled model intercomparison project is specifically focusing on modeling tipping points that aren't captured by current climate models. There is current modeling that used, it's called freshwater hosing, where they model the increased freshwater flux from the Greenland ice melt. There are other tipping elements such as abrupt permafrost thaw, which we may be starting to see in the Arctic, as well as there may be a regime shift in sea ice in the southern hemisphere at the South Pole. So it's not really the state of the art for deep uncertainty, and there also will be what if scenarios modeled. I did provide some information on the Southwest scientists are recommending using a what if the current La Nina-like trend in the Pacific continues. So it's really important, and I'd ask the climate scientists on the board to really clarify what you've looked at and been able to look at, because you focused just on the regional efforts and what's being used, because it's really important to try to incorporate some of this new information as we're seeing. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Deirdre. Those are really useful comments. And I think they essentially harken back to what Obe and Diane brought up too, about really paying attention to tipping points. I think Obe wants to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, a couple of points. I think, we basically, Shokul just looked at what scenarios have been used in the past, and obviously CMIP-7 might be important, Maybe some of these are based on CMIP 5 or CMIP 6. But I think the important aspect is the board is planning to look at this, get an update on the climate science through, probably early next year. Maybe this is something, Lisa, you might mention as part of our work plan. That's when we will probably bring the, other scientists, and then also get an update on, how does this CMIP 7 like modeling will affect regionally. I think what matters is in the context of Bay Delta, how do those global climate change impacts translate to regionally California Bay Delta region? But we'll get an update on that. I think it's, pretty soon, hopefully.
Yeah, thanks, Obey. So we are planning on looking into more, like, what is the current state of climate modeling? But I also think, Diane phrased it very nicely, thinking about, like, as you, downscale that, or whatever you want to call it, to the local region, what is it driving that's really important to policies and goals? So I think that, and I think the other take home from Deirdre's comment is we probably need to, as we're analyzing the inventory of scenarios, really kind of create some kind of gap analysis of, here are some potential tipping points and thresholds that weren't included in scenarios or something like that, that we can take a broader look at what uncertainties are missing. It could be pretty interesting. Okay, any other last comments from the board? All right, well, we'll close this discussion, but we're gonna have many more opportunities to discuss how to package up these results and share them with others. But I think this discussion today was great, and I think gave us a lot of food for thought. So now let's take a 15-minute break. Let's come back at 10 of the hour, and then we'll move into this discussing the subsidence review. So we need to be ready for that when we come back. Thanks, everyone. All right, it looks to me like everybody's back. Why don't we go ahead and get started? Thanks, everyone, for being so punctual today. It's uncharacteristic of us. So now we're on to agenda item number 7, a discussion of the subsidence review. So you all got a copy of the current draft in your meeting packet. And just to remind folks, the background on this document, on October 19th to the 20th, 2023, we had held a public workshop in Sacramento that focused on basic and applied science that would improve management of subsided lands in the Delta. And we've discussed this we had a public review draft at our last meeting. And the review leads incorporated edits into a revised draft based on our comments. And so now I'm just going to turn it over to Tom Holzer to provide an overview of the revisions, and then we can discuss whether this is ready for public release. So take it away, Tom.
Okay. Yeah, I'm hoping that we will decide that it's ready for public release. So that's the goal here. And I think Julie's comments and her interest in the subsidence report sort of illustrate the importance of getting the public comments, because I think there's going to be enough interest in this. The comments we'll be getting will be very helpful in terms of fine-tuning the report and perhaps even identifying issues that we haven't adequately addressed. We have gone through and addressed your comments from last time. I didn't do as good a job as Bob did in terms of creating a linked document, but I have notes that show where we responded. I did want to mention a couple specific things, then I'll turn it over to Diane and Tanya. We've tried to emphasize sea level rise a little bit more in the current issue. And in some respects, I think this concern about the magnitudes of sea level rise are missing the real issue here. The issue is that for about 150 years, we've lived with a stable sea level. In other words, a stationary sea level. And so we've sort of looked at the elevation issue in the Delta from that perspective, and we look at levees from that perspective. Well, that's not reality anymore. We're dealing now with a non-stationary sea level, and the the actual numbers are, the absolute numbers are not what's the issue here. We're talking about meters of sea level rise for the next 150 years. Unless humans intervene in some drastic, unforeseen way, we're stuck with just the inertia of what's happening already with climate change. So that I think the way we look at managing elevation in the Delta is going to have to change in that context, that we're just living in a different world. And so I've tried to make that point. It's not perhaps as comprehensive as it could be, but considering the scale, the size of the report, we've tried to introduce that into the definition, the problem definition. And then the other thing I'd like to emphasize is we had some helpful comments from Campbell Ingram, the director of the Delta Conservancy, in which he spelled out the efforts. And I think in the last draft that you looked at, you could look at that as our description of it wasn't positive enough. I think we're actually at a turning point where we're starting to try and figure out how to deal with this elevation of the land issue in the Delta. And even though the efforts are still kind of limited, they're important because we're doing the kind of experiments you need to do to figure out how we're going to deal with the subsidence. So those are the two points I wanted to emphasize in what's in the revision. There's been a lot more editing that we've been doing, and I'll turn it over to Diane now.
yes, thanks, Tom. And I would say that the biogeochemistry section has been very challenging, and to write it in the context where we're explaining enough about these issues and how it works in terms of the multiple greenhouse gases and the connection to hydrology, trying to do that in a succinct way that doesn't overwhelm the text and yet supports the recommendations. And so we recognize, we have three fairly crisp recommendations and we are hoping that when this goes out to review for broader comment, that we've hit the mark in terms of balancing the level of information and making compelling recommendations. But I see this as an area where we are optimistic that we've hit this mark, but we won't know till we get public feedback. And there may be some individuals or some stakeholders where they can accept that there's this uncertainty in terms of all these different greenhouse gases and the role of sulfate and hydrology. And yet they clearly see that this needs to be studied more and considered moving forward. And that, yeah, so that's kind of where we are. But in that sense, I don't see a need. I'm hoping that the next step will of getting input from the broad range of stakeholders will be very helpful. Is that Tanya?
Sure. Great. I'll just add a couple additional things. Is that it, Diane?
That's what I mainly wanted to say.
I totally agree on that point. And I'll just add a couple additional things related to the revisions that I focused on. One of the big picture kind of comments I think we heard at the last meeting was that our statements on the recommendations themselves kind of sounded a little vague, or that some of them sounded like we were suggesting some kind of generic long-term research programs be developed, and that we needed to be a little more precise with how we targeted some of those recommendations. So I think we really worked on rewording those. And we had some good suggestions from, I think, Bob and in the previous text as well, that hopefully we've gotten that wording a little more sharp, or a little sharper. And let's see, in the agricultural practices section, I think most of the changes just related to clarifying a few things and sharpening those recommendations. And then in the final section of the recommendations on the landscape challenges, we did tweak the wording there to get rid of landscape scale, which I think Virginia had recommended, and then added more specificity in that section on the carbon markets and how they're being developed right now and kind of the state that they're in. And Lisa had asked for some of those additions, so we expanded that section a bit. But again, there's always this tension, I think, as Diane was hitting at, of how much do we explain in that front end of the report with technical details versus trying to make it concise and easily digestible. So we tried to strike that balance, and we'll see if we've achieved it.
I have a comment. If no one else does, I'll raise my hand. So yeah, I really appreciate how much work you guys have done on this to clarify things and respond to our comments. I think it reads well, and there's just a lot of good information in here. But putting on my economics hat, I did have one issue when, you know, with the transition from the biogeochemistry into the land, what do you call this second, agricultural practices section. So let me know if I got this wrong, but when I read the biogeochem, I was left with this idea that we really don't know what the net flux of greenhouse gases would be in most cases from, say, implementing polluted culture. And then we get into the agricultural practices, and it talks about how carbon credits are already being given and how we should be incentivizing this. And I'm feeling a bit of a disconnect of, you know, if we're doing it for elevation and other, you know, levee stability, things like that, then this makes a lot of sense. But it seems to me we don't really know what the net benefits are. And I'm a little confused how we're getting carbon credits when we have such scientific uncertainty. And so I just would like a little bit more of a connection between where I'm left in the biogeochem and where we go to in the ag practices. And I don't think this is a huge change to what you have. I think it's just a matter of sort of maybe acknowledging that uncertainty in the biogeochem section a little more clearly. And then I do have some suggestions for wordsmithing on the polluticulture, just to remind people that we know this is good for elevation. We're not so sure about the greenhouse gases, something like that.
Well, I think we're confident about the,
sorry, we're confident about the greenhouse.
Yeah. We're confident about the greenhouse gases. It's just there's a lot of uncertainty with it right now because of our understanding of the multiple gases is not complete.
Well, and I would say that there's uncertainty about that we've tried to explain about how the projections based on what happens in the first few years might change as we understand more, whereas the peat accumulates more organic matter, it seems that the greenhouse gas production rates go down, and yet some of the models assume that they're constant. So maybe we could clarify that some of the uncertainty would go in the direction of making it even more economically beneficial in terms of actually sequestering more carbon than there is greenhouse gas release. You know, that would be a point that could be added.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, that would be somewhat speculative, but we could add that and say that more explicitly.
Yeah, I agree with that, Diane, because that's the point of doing that research.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that... yeah, that would be the point of the research. So maybe we could add that in the last paragraph about recommendations, and that might support the transition.
That sounds useful, or I think even in some of the figure captions, which just living up to what Julie Lee said about me, that I like to have things be in plain language. I also think we could make the figure captions a little clearer for the non-specialist without adding too much text. Or I think there's some simple ways to make it a little easier to understand, like just defining crossover time, for example, and things like that. So I can give you some specifics, but just in
Sure,
the full
sure.
disclosure that I have some comments there too.
Well, thanks for that point. Yeah, I think we could work on that.
Okay, other comments for the team? Anna.
I just have a very high level comment, and I like the discussion that just took place now. We have spent a lot of time discussing this draft report, and I know that the last time around there was a lot of back and forth as well. I also remember there was a bit of a concern, I'm not sure if concern is the right word, but a comment that was raised by one of the public comments in terms of the time that has already passed since the workshop until the draft report. And so while I completely recognize and we could continue to iterate on this internally, it seems to me that it's really time to get public comment on this report. And Edmund would have tell us what the process is here. But I think it would be very important that during that public comment process that we make sure that those who participated in the workshop and were some of the experts from whom we heard saw the draft and felt encouraged to provide their feedback, and let that process inform any final edits for the final version of the report. I worry a little bit that we could continue this internal process almost indefinitely, but getting that additional external input would be really helpful at this point.
Well, thanks. And before we take the next comment, I just want to clarify, we can still finalize this report as long as we give Tom and anyone else who wants to contribute, we say these are our comments. We trust you to make finalize this. So this doesn't have to turn into an endless iteration. So even if we make some
No, I
comments.
understand. I understand that we can vote to essentially release it for public review pending these additional comments being incorporated, which we have done before. I'm just expressing that in my mind the benefit of releasing it is starting to be larger than the benefit of asking the authors to spend too much time incorporating additional feedback. And anyways, it's not at all to discount the comments that Lisa, you and others have made as well.
Okay. I think we can, it's fair to ask them to make things clearer so that the public has a better opportunity to comment. So, yeah, okay.
I only have one minor point. I'm looking at the track changes version on page four. I think Tom earlier talked about the sea level rise characterization. I was curious, in here it says during the last 2 millennia, sea level has been unchanging, i.e., stationary. I was wondering if unchanging is a little bit of a strong word because you have natural variability. So can we just say during the last 2 millennia, sea level has been stationary?
Yeah, what happened there was I realized I had to define the word stationary for most of the readers.
Right. But then you use a non-stationary lit in the next sentence. But anyway, it's probably
Yeah.
not a big deal, but somebody could say, there's always natural variability in the sea level
Yeah.
process. Anyway, just a comment.
Yeah, the wording there was tricky because I'm talking to an audience that's not going to know what stationary and
Right.
non-stationary mean. And so
Yeah.
I had to define it, and I didn't want to distract them with the definition. So.
Maybe has been stable or something like that.
Okay, I'll look.
Okay.
Stable's a good word.
Yeah, which is what you used earlier, I think. So anyway, that's all I have.
Thanks, Bob.
I agree with Anna that The report needs to get out to the public relatively soon. And certainly there's probably a few more changes for clarity and readability that need to be made. Unfortunately, I am not able to comment on this version. I only received the document like 48 hours ago, and I didn't get any advance notice, and I've been gone, well, I was gone all day yesterday, so I haven't been able to read it, so I don't know whether to say yay or nay. I'll probably have to abstain if we vote today, but if you're amenable to receiving comments, say by next Tuesday or so, I can probably read it by then and give you my feelings about it. But I have to say, I have to kind of stand back from this discussion and trust that you responded well to the comments that were made previously. So anyway, sorry about that.
Yeah, Bob, I want to thank you for your earlier comments. They were quite comprehensive, and we went through the document. And I think we addressed all of them.
So. Okay, very good. That would be great. But give me a chance to, if you can give me a chance to look it over. And if not, the board should do, make the decision and do as Anna says, move forward and get the public comments now.
No, your wish is granted.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Inga.
I just wanted to say very little time to review. I just focused on my own comment to see what you did with it, and I was happy with it, with the way you dealt with it, the water quality issues with the rice farming. And that's it. So I'm ready to vote.
All right. Any other comments? All right. Well, and at this point, then I'll be seeking a motion to approve the report pending these changes.
We also need public comments too.
Oh, public comments. Thanks. Sorry, I had lost my place in my notes. Any public comments, Edmund?
There are none.
Thank you. Okay, so the suggested motion is to have Tom and others address comments from the board and work with staff to release this report for a 60-day public comment period. So do I have someone willing to make that motion? Virginia, is that you volunteering?
Yes, it is. So I move that the board accept the version as is with minor edits based on the comments of the board and to be submitted within the next few days, and then the report released to the public for their review.
Okay, and Inga, are you seconding?
Yes, I'm seconding.
Do it now while you can, because once you're chair, you can't. So,
telling me.
Okay, great. So we have a motion. We have a second. Let's do a roll call vote. Virginia?
I approve.
Tanya?
I approve.
Tom?
I approve.
Anna?
I approve.
Diane?
I approve.
Bob?
I'm going to abstain. I haven't read it yet, but I abstain.
Okay. Obey?
Yeah. I approve, but I just want to have a clarification. I think when Diane said few days, can we not wait until like next Tuesday when Bob will provide the comments?
Right. So I think, yeah, that was a little part of this. Yeah. Can we, are you, Virginia, hopefully you're okay with maybe omitting the part about the next few days, but just soon?
Okay, soon. Don't see any difference.
Bob wanted a week to respond, so
soon.
I was hoping we could sort of fudge that a little, but yeah, let's be clear. Okay, and then Inga, you're muted.
Yes,
and then Thanks. And then I also vote to approve with, I'm going to send some comments that I think will help the clarity. Okay. All right. Well, with that, the motion passes. And so now, Tom, you're on the hook to address those comments, and we'll look for that to be released soon. Wonderful.
Yeah, I just about have it memorized now. So.
I bet you do. Been over that text a lot of times.
Then we change it again, and then you have to read.
Yeah. Yeah, your track changes in your head now.
Right? When he goes to sleep
I'll
at
turn
night.
It on for
I have a stack of edited versions that on my desk here that go way back. That I print them out to read them over, try to see if some of the comments that come in, we maybe there was something that we said before that could help us respond. You know, there's that circularity that can.
Yeah.
Yeah,
these comments start to get circular after a while. People want you to change it back to the way it was. Yeah. Yeah. Good time to cut bait on this one and let it get out there. And Diane, I want to say I have comments on the figure captions in BioGeoChem, but I think you did an amazing job very succinctly explaining those graphics. But I think I just can tweak them a little bit to make it even clearer for us non-biogeochemists.
Well, there's other people deserve credit for that as well.
Okay. Whoever contributed, probably Lisa Marie helped too. Yeah. Okay. All right. So we'll move on to the next agenda item. So agenda item 8 is a discussion of the Delta Conveyance Project Final Environmental Impact Report Review. And this is on me. So first, the background. The California Department of Water Resources released the final environmental impact report for the Delta Conveyance Project on December 8th, 2023, and certified the report on December 21st, 2023. So we've been discussing the final environmental impact report at previous public meetings, and we're drafting a memo on how our comments on the draft environmental impact report were addressed. So various board members contributed their comments, and now we are, you know, incorporating, most of them have been incorporated, but we're still working on the draft to be prepared to be discussed next month. So there were some things that I and also Kenny Rose helped do was sort of put the comments into themes and some of, and try to make the comments more parallel in terms of how they were structured. So some of the ways I did that were by linking the new comments back to original comments, grouping related points, and then tightening the text to really focus on inadequacies of the response and the final EIR. But of course, you all will get a chance to see if you agree with how that was done. But now I just put together a few slides to describe what's in at this point, how it's organized. And you can let me know if you think there's any big, if there's any big gaps. Okay, so next slide, please. So right now it's organized in three sections. So several of us had comments about recurring responses that we felt were unresponsive. And so that's part one, is there are these three recurring responses that we had concerns about. Then there's the priority issues or themes. And this is where Kenny was a big help pulling together some themes. And it was interesting that some of the themes were parallel to what was going on in the review of the operations, the long-term operations of the Central Valley Project. So that was a twofer in a way that we were seeing a lot of common themes across two different reviews. And then the third part is the appendix, where there's some more detailed comments that we thought would be helpful. And then they're broken down by chapter. Okay, next slide, please. So now we'll break down each of those sections. So in terms of the recurring responses, the three that were mentioned in our comments were this, you know, the EIR evaluates the full range of potential impacts that may result from construction, maintenance, and operation. And this was repeated often in response to our comments, and basically used to say that no revisions were needed because it's complete, and it complied with CEQA. The other concern is that when we suggested that greater variability be included, it was sometimes said that that was too speculative to include future variability. The second point was that a lot of our comments fall outside of CEQA, but I think we see a little bit of a disconnect in that the EIR goes outside of CEQA. And in fact, many of the comments that received this response were often aimed at improving those extra analyses. So that seemed a little bit of a disconnect. And then this issue of the socioeconomic effects don't really matter unless they change the physical environment is really perhaps not consistent with a lot of the policies in the Delta and just the concept of socio-ecological systems guiding, you know, how policy should be implemented. So that's those. Next slide, please. And then these are how we group things under major themes. Some details and examples of how climate change was not adequately accounted for. We brought up the issue about time and space scales of models needing to be reconciled to really capture ecological outcomes. And you know, the big example, of course, is that the CalSim-3 output is monthly, but it's used to drive ecological models that require much more short-term resolution to be effective at judging fish outcomes. Third one was that cumulative impacts, particularly on fish species and ecosystem function, were not really given adequate analysis. And sometimes the scope was overly narrow. The issue about seismic risk may be overstated. That affects, you know, the perceived benefits of the project. And then the report presentation remains difficult to use. And that comment on the bottom is just reminding folks that there were a lot of commonalities between our review and the effects analysis being prepared for the long-term operations of the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project. And so I think we thought that was important to draw those parallels because it's even more meaningful if two different groups are saying the same things. Okay, next slide just talks about the appendix. So the appendix is where a lot of the water quality comments were there, the terrestrial biota, and the details on seismic risk and fish effects, more details on those. I think I just realized that one slide might have been deleted that I put in here, maybe on purpose, but overall, our intro comment is along the lines of, yes, some positive changes were made in response to our comments, but we just didn't feel the responses were adequate in a lot of cases. And so that's how we open the report at this point, and then we get into these other details. So do folks feel that, I know you're not seeing the details, but what do you think of that organization? Do you think anything important is missing? Would you like to see stuff elevated into the major themes that aren't there? Those are my questions. If you can even respond, just having seen this for the first time. So go ahead, Obi.
Yeah, I do have a couple of comments or questions actually. One is that you make references to the other review, but I was curious if there would be a perception that we use other information to counter the revisions that they made. And I was wondering how you were going to reference that. You know, that's number one. Number two is you mentioned, to my knowledge, they really didn't address many of our comments. So how much credit are we going to give for addressing our comments? I wasn't sure.
Yeah, we definitely did not emphasize that they made a lot of good changes. I mean, you know, there's a lot of little, teeny little changes, I think, that we can say are responsive to our comments. But I think this was actually Anna's wording. Although some minor changes were made in response to our comments, the responses generally did not lead to meaningful changes in the EIR, and the ISB stands by many of its original comments. So that's
oh, okay.
The opening statement. But to your question about how to talk about the two different reviews, we did struggle with that. And I welcome your comments when you see the final version. But what we did was we tied things back to our original comments. So we didn't bring in any new comments that were unrelated to our original comments. We say our comments first, and then we say, and also in this other review, something very similar was said, and it's the same models and some of the same model runs were used in the EIR as were used for the long-term operation. So we tried to explain why we thought those comments were relevant. But I think, you know, ultimately you can be the judge of whether we did that successfully. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that's fine. I'll try to read the document.
In fact, it was a lot of your comments that were the same as the ones from them.
Yeah.
So I think you'll find it only backs up.
Okay. Yeah.
People feeling generally satisfied with that. Again, I know it's hard to respond without the details, Inga.
Yeah, I think, it has to be fairly general, this letter. And as long as our sentiment that our comments were largely ignored comes across, I think this is fine, you know.
Yeah, I do think there just was a lot of brushing up off of our comments, even in some cases, like I think Tom made the point at our last meeting that it wouldn't have been that hard to address the seismic discussion, and yet it wasn't done. So we didn't understand, it was just not clear why some of those comments were not dealt with. And then I know we agreed not to take on the whole issue of how CEQA is structured, but yet when you see sort of the disconnect between, well, we don't have to do that, but you did it. So, there's, how do we effectively support decisions? Clearly they think sometimes you need to go beyond CEQA. So then where do you draw the line between what's in and what's out? And I think, we were just making a lot of suggestions about more things that needed to be in for effective decision support. Okay, well, this isn't an action item today. It's just an update and to get any sort of major concerns on the table. Do we have any public comments, Edmund?
We have one from Deirdre at Desjardins. Deirdre, you have the ability to unmute your microphone. Thank you.
Thank you. Deirdre Desjardins, and I wanted to thank the board so much for their effort on this, and I'm just sad to see this is the second round of essentially ignoring comments from the Delta Independent Science Board, and the project was, there was going to be a finding that the Twin Tunnels project was not consistent with the Delta Plan's requirement for best available science. The intent of the legislature was best available science on climate change, including hydrology and sea level rise, would be used in the project. And it's something I've devoted a huge amount of time to commenting on, and this continues to be a project. It basically started out as a large ditch at Hood that was very similar to the peripheral canal that had been first proposed in the 1960s. So I really commend you, and I think this is incredibly important. And this is the water supply for Southern California, and I'm very concerned that impacts of climate change aren't being adequately considered, and particularly uncertainties. I've seen the Santa Clara Valley Water Agency use an absolute number for water yields from a project, and it's really a bad way to sell the project to decision makers. Thank you.
Thank you, Deirdre. And I know you're active in commenting on other activities going on, so this topic will not go away. All right. Any other comments from the board? Are we done with this topic? I know you'll have comments once you see the written material, but we'll just leave it there then. Oh, Diane, please go ahead.
So I have a question about the timeline for this project. being going ahead. You know, I don't have a sense of that. If someone else knows, is this something that will be, you know, in 6 months, that'll be thumbs up, or is it a year?
Oh, that you mean the Delta Conveyance Project itself?
Yeah.
That's a pretty complicated topic because it, you know, it depends on funding and, you know, people agreeing to buy the water and things like that. So I don't know if we want to get into that. Edmund or Lauren, do you want to make a quick comment here? Or I will say that some people have wondered, why are we doing this when it's already been approved? And the point is that there are still other public processes to happen, and our report can be fodder for other public processes that are part of the decision-making of getting this project, you know, in the ground. So yeah, Edmund, do you want to add something here?
Oh yeah, I was just going to say, we haven't seen an updated timeline from DWR, but they're going through various other regulatory processes before this project is approved. CEQA is just one of the requirements, but there's other processes that are currently ongoing or occurring.
Right, and that's what our report might support. And we are aiming to get this draft made public, you know, and hopefully available for your approval for the next meeting. So we'll get it out there in time for some of these processes. So
thanks.
Okay, well, with that, I'll close this discussion on this, and this will not be the end of it, and you'll see a draft soon. Okay, agenda item 9 is a discussion of future activities. So this should be the most fun part of the workshop of the meeting today. So right now we're in the process of wrapping up 3 ISB reviews, and well, probably more, 4, I guess. We need to start planning our future activities so that, you know, we can get rolling on new ideas. And so we have 2 current ideas floating around, a contaminants review and a workshop on the state of climate change science. And just to let the public know, we will be taking comments after the board discusses. But first, I'm just going to turn it over to Inga, who has taken the lead on the contaminants review.
Yeah, if I can manage this unmute button here. Thank you. So as it stands, for the preliminary goal for this contaminant monitoring review is to assess if current monitoring and assessment in the Delta is capable of detecting threats of contaminants to the ecological health of the system. The main focus of this review will be on surface waters and risk assessment for aquatic species. So not human impacts at this point, no drinking water, that kind of thing. So we presented this preliminary scope to the ISB and the council in April of this year. In the meantime, and thanks a lot to Margot Metzen, we assembled background information for the draft prospectus and plan to conduct, scoping discussions in the fall to inform the scope of the review and the prospectus. If approved, more extensive interviews with key players would be conducted during the research phase of the review, which would probably be next year. So that's where we are. There's a draft prospectus in the works, and we hope to have that by the end of this year, after the scoping discussions. That's it for now. Do you have any questions?
So remind us how the council responded to the, sorry, Bob, I'll let you go, but how did the council respond to the scoping? Were they okay with focusing on species and not people?
I think so, yes. I think the only question I remember that you relayed to me was if PFAS would be included, and that, yes, that would be part of it, so. I think they were pretty positive. I wasn't there. You were there.
Shows how faulty the memory is. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, Bob, go ahead.
Hi, Inga. I only have a small concern, and it's truly small, is I received the email from Margot, I guess, and yourself, you're included, about the scoping process that you and Margot were going to do it alone because of the, say, the logistics were easier. And it caused me just a little bit of concern, is that I think there's a I know for myself and maybe others, you know, who might be involved, is that we really need to be educated as we go along, and being somehow included in the scoping process and the development of the prospectus, I think is pretty important, or it could be pretty important. And I just throw that out there because I think for a lot of us that would be somewhat involved in this, is we're not as well or not as knowledgeable as you are on a lot of these things. And it might be at least informative for us to hear what others have to say during the scoping process, if anything, just for educational, you know, to educate us. So I throw that out there. It's a small concern. And I think if we're not included, we can catch up later. But you know, thinking about kind of building that team from the beginning is to me is pretty important. So I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Well, as far as I recall, in the email, it also said, if you want to participate, let us know. So we're not excluding anybody at this point. We just thought, for practical reasons, mostly, we wanted these scoping discussions to be in person, and it's not really a formal approach that we're taking here. We would just like to hear from people who are knowledgeable of the system and know what's going on in terms of contaminant monitoring. We wanted to get some input to actually develop the prospectus, you know, because we don't want to do that on our own. We would like to have the knowledge what people think is actually needed rather than charging ahead. And because in-person meetings are a bit hard with the board and with us, we thought it would be easier to do it this way. But if you feel strongly about that, we'll figure out a way to for you to participate. Tom,
it's just really a minor concern, but you know, in terms of kind of educating us all at the same time, and you know, building a team from the beginning, and I don't know if it'd be beneficial or not, but I just throw that out there for, you know, something for you and Margot to consider. So,
no, we did think about that. I just saw the education process beginning after this. So, but we can talk about that. All right. Tom?
Yeah, I second Bob's point about the education process. As the senior member on the board here, I've probably been through the most reviews, some of which I didn't have a lot of expertise, but being there right from the beginning was always very helpful as I learned the issue more clearly. So getting people involved from the beginning, I think, is important. And it'll be a reward to you in the end, because that person will be able to contribute more to the actual reviews.
Yeah, I mean, the same answer applies to your comment, but thank you, Tom. Yeah. Diane?
I was going to say that one of the advantages of having informal in-person meetings is that you may obtain insight from what people are willing to say to you in an in-person meeting that may not be said in a more formal meeting. So I think getting that those perspectives in terms of there's always many challenges with monitoring programs, and there may be issues that you want to know about that won't come forward in a Zoom call with 12 people. Did you see what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying.
I think that's important input. And so I don't want to discourage you from having in-person meetings early on.
Yeah, well, that was my sentiment as well. If you have more formal, that's why I said the more formal interviews will be part of the actual research that we're doing for this review, right? So this is the informal educational for us part. So, but I definitely take it very seriously what Tom and Bob have said, and I don't want to, you know, be elitist from the start and not include people who want to be included from the start. So we'll give it some more thought and try to figure out how to approach this best, I think.
Yeah, that I think that would be in keeping with, you know, how the board has been transitioning over time, to just try to engage the potential end users of the information in particular early, and then as well as just knowledgeable folk who, like we heard from Gail Cosio earlier, like there's just folks around with a lot of institutional knowledge, and silly not to just touch base with them too. So I think that's definitely something to think about. And you know, you can rely on staff to help with logistics. I know it is challenging, particularly over the summer, but maybe we can work something out.
Yeah, I'm sure. Want to keep everybody involved and everybody happy.
Okay, great. So let's transition to the other idea, the workshop on the state of climate change. So there was interest in the June meeting to present research on the state of climate change research and how organizers are considering climate change. And we drafted a goal to have a workshop in early 2024. And Obey and Anna have agreed to take the lead on that effort. And if others want to join in, let staff know. And there's a goal to quickly put together a prospectus to allow for preparation for a February 24 workshop. So Anna, please go ahead.
Just clarifying, 25, not 24.
Oh, right. Very good. Yep. So I'm mindlessly reading my notes, which have the wrong date. Thank you. Right. We're not going to go back in time. Haven't figured that out yet. Yeah. Obey, do you want to add anything?
I think the idea is to have a workshop, or maybe more than one, I'm not sure, but similar to subsidence workshop or food web workshop, to bring in some experts who understand the global implications for Bay Delta region in various drivers that are important. This workshop became even more important after the DMDU review. So my thoughts are that we will invite some well-known scientists in the region or elsewhere. And basically, we welcome any input on who should be at the workshop in terms of panelists, or and hopefully that will be described in the prospectus that Margot is working on.
Yeah, that sounds super useful, and I'm glad you're taking the lead on that, Obey, since you have such knowledge about how this stuff gets applied in practice. But that's my main comment would be, you know, just like we heard about with the decision scaling, is it's easy to generate a bunch of information that is really hard to use. So I would love if we could really find some case studies where folks are figuring out, you know, what to do with these variabilities and projections, and you know, what kind of timescales matter to infrastructure projects and things like that. I think, you know, to ground it, I think would be super helpful. Tom?
I think that Lisa is muted,
I'm
telling
saying
Tom that he's muted.
I'm saying Tom, you're muted while I'm muted. That just shows how good we're getting at this.
So, sorry about that. Are you thinking we'll do both climate change and sea level rise in one workshop?
Yes, that was my thinking. You know, all the drivers that are important from a climate point of view. I mean, sea level rise to me is part of climate change. So, you know, my thought would be to include sea level rise, climate change, and then maybe some implications like I think Lisa was talking about, even implications on hydrology of the watersheds that, you know, due to forest fires. I don't want to make it too big of a scope, but, you know, things that are of interest to us now, I think those are the points.
But try to focus on the Delta, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Bay Delta region. Yep.
Diane?
Yes, I was going to comment that in addition to these broader uncertainties in terms of atmospheric circulation and oceanic circulation that have been mentioned already, at the European Geophysical Union meeting this spring and some of the climate sessions, there was a whole climate session focused on the uncertainty or how the timeline in which the global community gets serious about addressing greenhouse gas emissions will impact the timeline to mitigate some of the impacts. So it was a really fascinating session. And so that rather than these scenarios that are, you know, mitigating this, that, and the other as a percent, but understanding the uncertainty related to when, you know, if does the world community do something substantial in 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years, I thought was really fascinating. And I think that would be helpful to be bring into a workshop in some way. Not even if it's not yet specific for the Northern California region, but to bring those perspectives in. And I think I recalled a paper that presentation about what this would mean for the Netherlands, for example.
Right.
It's different time points. Yes.
Yeah.
Could you send, I guess, Edmund a link to, I'm assuming all those sessions and the abstract that are in are archived somewhere online. If you have that link, it would be interesting to take a look. And I understand the geographic context is very different, but I think it'd still be helpful.
Yeah, I can do that. I will do that. Yeah.
And, you know, the AGU meeting is coming up. There might be some new, you know, science reported there as well.
Yeah, the abstracts are all in. They're at the stage where they're, you know, reshuffling sessions and assigning presentations. I don't know if anyone would have the time, but at this point, AGU is so huge and there's so many sessions that if there's someone who would have the bandwidth to, I hate the words to say the word comb through, but essentially comb through the sessions, at least if not the individual abstracts, and point out ones that might be relevant, that could be. And I think that's what you're suggesting, Obe, is you know, give us ideas of potential speakers to have for presentations.
Yeah, I mean, I can take a look at that. And obviously, like you said, it's 25,000 people, and I don't know how many abstracts. But I will try to take a look at it, and maybe others might do the same. I don't know if how many of you are attending, but I plan to attend.
I'll be there too.
I'll be there as well. And I think the program hasn't been released yet. So I can't, no. I think we can't see the abstracts yet.
Some abstracts you can see.
Yeah, the interface changed a few years ago. So you can see abstracts that are submitted even before they're assigned to talks and whatnot.
Yeah.
But again, it's, you know, as an example, just the atmospheric sciences session has about 150 sessions, you know, and so it's, and this could fall under multiple sections of AGU. So it is,
yeah,
it is a lot. But
whatever. Is this the job for AI?
Well, you know, one quickly, I know Tom had the hands up, but you know, also the AMS meeting might be important. I'm not planning to go there. I don't know anybody is going to AMS meeting. That might be another venue to look at the latest science.
You know, Obe, you said something about a couple sessions too. I mean, it does sound like a lot is being asked of this one workshop at this point. You know, we have also used ISB meetings to explore issues. You know, you could think about if maybe one talk doesn't fit into the workshop, but you want to just put that onto the agenda. That's another option.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what discussions you want to have. I mean, obviously you want to take advantage of people in breakout groups having certain discussions, but, you know, just something to think about.
Yeah, we might want to revisit the scope as we plan for the workshop, but we'll see. I was thinking about all the questions that came up during the EIR review and also the MDU work and all the other stuff we are doing. Because the science is evolving so rapidly in the climate arena, we just want to get the latest. And particularly about Bay Delta region. And there are like Dan Kayan and a few others who are very familiar with the region. So,
right. But of course, we want to know, is the region using the best science?
Yeah.
We need to go outside too, right? To see.
Right. Yeah. And also for us to understand what to expect based on the best available science.
Right. But maybe filtering by things that have policy relevance, like
Diane
mentioned earlier. Yeah. Okay. Right. All right. Well, this sounds like a lot of good fodder, and we'll let you guys try to get through some of that. Do we have any public comments, Evan, on either topic?
Yes, so we have a public comment from Deirdre Desjardins. Deirdre, you have the ability to unmute your microphone. Thank you.
I've been following the work of there's a number of IPCC authors and lead authors, and Mark Zelenka is one of the key issues is the step increase in temperatures in 2023-24, and there's a question as to whether sea surface temperatures haven't gone down, and people are still kind of waiting to see. We're definitely going into a La Nina. There will be a session on causes, but it's very relevant to the Western North American hydroclimate because one of the hot spots for warm sea surface temperatures is in the North Pacific. So I can help you a little bit with that. And Mark Zelenka, who's an IPCC lead author on Chapter 7, is actually in California. So there are some major questions. Another issue, there was some modeling a few years ago at UCLA, which showed that the snow albedo feedback is likely to cause an extra, I think it's 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit warming the Sierra Mountains. That's not captured by current climate models. So I think these have everything to do with the watershed. And I'll try and get you a little more info.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you, Deirdre.
And one other thing, I've done a nonlinear analysis and fitting a lowest curve and looking for change points. And there is a change point in where there's a step increase in temperatures in the Western U.S. in 2013, just as we emerge from the global warming hiatus.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get you that.
Thank you, Deirdre. Edmund, do we have any other public comments?
No additional comments. Thank you.
Okay, great. All right. Any other comments from the board on moving these ideas along? And also, folks, you know, there potentially is room for other activities too. If folks have other ideas they want like to float, we can also discuss, you know, what else we might want to take on. Okay. All right. Well, the next agenda item is my reflections on being chair, since this is my last meeting. So I had wanted to keep these really brief, but as I started putting down some thoughts, it turned into a state of the ISB board statement. So it's a little longer. So, you know, as Julie said, get some coffee if you need it. But I just want to just let folks know that I really am grateful for the opportunity to have served as chair of this well-respected board. You know, it's really been an honor to work alongside all of you dedicated and brilliant people. And one of the things I really love about how the board works is just how wonderfully people complement each other and bringing in their distinct perspectives to our reviews and all our endeavors to promote the best science. And I think the board's working really well right now. And I don't take credit for that. I'm just happy to be part of this. I do see how the board has evolved in the past couple of years. So, you know, not all of us are part of this evolution, that we've responded to the ISB assessment, also known as the Hastings et al. Report, by connecting more meaningfully with interested parties during a review process. And also, we've become more flexible in the types of products that we produce and where we go to share information with interested parties. And I think that's really paid off in a lot of ways. We've held some really well-received workshops and seminars. And recently we heard ways in which some of our recently completed reviews were being used in decision-making, which is, I guess, ultimately the most satisfying thing we can do. In particular, I think our collective efforts have had a meaningful impact on monitoring strategies and also forward thinking on water supply reliability. So we fanned the flames of the work in several ways, such as when Anna and Inga reviewed the CyanoHab monitoring strategy, they were able to reiterate themes for the monitoring enterprise review, but also bring in new perspectives. In terms of the Delta Conveyance project review, I think that some of the important science shortcomings that we identified there, such as how climate change uncertainty is being handled, will continue to reverberate. And obviously we're going to keep working on that. And we saw some similar concerns being raised in the long-term operations of the Central Valley Project review. So these are topical issues that we need to keep focusing on. So other board accomplishments are that we co-mentored 2 Sea Grant fellows and 2 postdocs who've all gone on to get jobs in fields of science application. And of course, you know, Lillian, one of the postdocs, is working at a federal agency here in the Delta, but all are contributing to environmental sustainability, and that's really nice to see. We helped bring on a talented new Delta lead scientist. And now we're wrapping up our most recent investigations into subsidence and upper trophic level food webs, although, you know, Bob is telling me it's not only upper trophic levels. And I think those efforts have already prompted some useful conversations, even though our report's not out. So, and I want to make sure to thank Tom and Bob for leading those efforts, but also the many contributions that everyone has made to explore these issues and share ideas for improving the science. And then, of course, I'm particularly pleased that we've made progress in promoting the use of social science research, particularly within the Delta Stewardship Council. We have our seminar series on decision-making under deep uncertainty, and I think the impact of that remains to be seen, but we do know that we've introduced some new ideas and concepts from decision science, psychology, economics, and other fields to the science enterprise that I think will probably take root in some way. And I think we look forward to sharing these additional analyses and syntheses that we discussed today, including the work of Shoko and Margot and others, to make those ideas more accessible. And I think that's what we still have to do on that review. The efforts that we've made to promote social science are being complemented by a lot of strong efforts within the council to use more social science. And so I just want to acknowledge that board member Tanya Heikkilä contributed her knowledge on governance research and its application to a webinar series. And both of us, as the ISB social scientists, try to participate in workshops and other venues where we can informally share understanding about social science and promote understanding. So I think, you know, the board really has accomplished a lot, and I just want folks to recognize that. This role of chair has really enriched me personally and professionally. I've learned so much from each of you and also the many scientists and decision makers who spent time with me to deepen my understanding of the Delta issues and really the role of the board in supporting decision makers. I have a lot more depth of understanding of how that works now. And I hope folks realize that a lot of people do look to us and really use our science. And so we should have faith that the products we're producing are really worth our time. And I think just together we've laid a really strong foundation for continued success of the ISB, and I'm really excited to see what the future holds under Inga's chairship and leadership. So thank you all. Thanks. That was a little long-winded for me, but I you know, it has been great to be your chair, and I know we're in good hands now with Inga.
Well, I have to say a few words. I think it will be a big shoe to fill after you, but I really look forward to working with you and Diane the next 2 years, and I'm glad to have you on my side, so by my side. Thank you.
I'm not disappearing immediately. Uh-oh, Tanya, you want to say something?
No, Lisa, I just want to say, you know, in public here, just how grateful I am that you've been in this leadership position over the last couple of years to have my fellow social scientists on the board. Keeping the social science flag in the air has been great, but I will also say one thing that I really respect about you is that you speak an interdisciplinary language, and you're so good at communicating across disciplines. I think someone who didn't know you and didn't have your CV in front of them or your bio in front of them wouldn't even know, is she an economist? Is she this? And it's just, it speaks to your ability to learn so many different things about a system like the Delta and to be well-versed in, you know, many of the technical areas that we grapple with. And you've just communicated that beautifully. And I think that's just a real gift that you have. So thank you for sharing that gift with us. It helps a lot in how we speak to each other as a board.
Very kind. Obey.
Yeah, Lisa, I want to echo what Tanya and Inga said also. You know, I felt like when I first came on board and you were just, I think, either taking over, but I remember how welcome I felt with your, you know, respect for everybody's opinion and being very fair to everybody. I felt it was an excellent environment that you created as a chair. So I want to thank you for carrying that through this whole 2 years I've been on. And I'm happy to see that you'll be around, you know, with us for some time. Again, thank you for all the work associated with the tough job you had up to now.
Thanks. Anna?
I wanted to echo many of the same things. I think you had just taken over as chair when Inga and I joined about 2 years ago. And I have really genuinely admired your leadership style ever since then. It's really one of you know, collaborative leadership and making sure that all voices are heard rather than you know, pushing one or another particular agenda. And so I have really, really enjoyed working with you. And I think that the board has accomplished a lot more with you at the helm than we would have otherwise. And I really like this model that you, this 6 year model. So you're stepping down and yet you're still around. And even after that, you're still part of the board. And so really looking forward to continue to work with you in the coming years. And Inga, you're very brave. We joined at the same time and here you are already as the chair. And so I'm sure you will do great as well. And I look forward to working with you as well. But it's a genuine pleasure to work with you both.
Very kind. Virginia.
Well, Lisa, I knew you beforehand, but I don't feel like I really knew you because I didn't appreciate the skill you have at listening carefully to these diverse perspectives all across these disciplines and understand them well enough to make intelligent and important, useful comments on how to proceed. So the balance that you have in recognizing the hard science as well as the social science, and including the perspectives of the community members who've participated with this, is really valuable. So I appreciate getting to know the depth of you and not just the one side I knew before.
Thanks, Tom.
Lisa, I have a pretty large sample size, and I can say with very small uncertainty, you've done well.
Appreciated. Appreciate the succinctness too. Yeah, Bob.
I just want to echo what others have said, and I think you've been an excellent chair, and I've really enjoyed working with you the last couple of years. So look forward to working with you, and now that you're back to being a board member. So. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Diane?
I also want to echo what everyone has said about how much I value your leadership. And you've really helped us keep focused on what's important, because a board like this can get waylaid. And it's been great to feel this sense of focus, and I value that.
Thank you. And you're not done with me yet, since I'll be in the chairship and you'll still have to listen to my ideas. But great. Well, you all are too kind. I do appreciate it. But really, I think we are all a group running this board. And I think a lot of people have shown a lot of leadership to keep us doing good things. And so I think we're a good team. All right. With that, let us move on. Are there public comments on this? Does the torture for me continue?
There are none.
Oh, good. We already had some nice public comments. Okay. Okay. Are there public comments for matters that are not on the agenda? So we're getting toward the end of the agenda here, the next thing being prep for upcoming meetings.
There are none.
Okay, great. All right. So then agenda item 12, prep for upcoming meetings. So when Inga takes over as chair, I won't be having to run this meeting, but in September, we'll be discussing the final environmental impact report comments that we surveyed today. We may have the Food Web's revised draft, although I think Bob just suggested it might be more like October. And then in October, we will be having our meeting right after that Bay Delta Science Conference, which many of us I know are planning to attend. And that in-person meeting is likely to have a field tour, where we'll learn about some aspect that we haven't learned about yet. And we'll be wanting to get people's reflections on the Bay Delta Science Conference and what we learned there as well. And maybe that will spawn some new ideas of topics we may want to review. And then our November meeting will be virtual, and we're expecting to have the Delta lead scientist, Lisa Marie, provide her vision. And this is a tradition that's been around for a while, to have the Delta lead scientist share their vision and how they want to use their position. And so that's what we have on the agenda so far. But of course, there will be new things popping up undoubtedly, and including some of the reports I mentioned during the chair report earlier that may come up for us to review and comment on. Okay, so now I'll hand it over to Edmund to review our action items.
Yep, and then there was no public comments for the previous agenda item. In terms of items for follow-up, today the board took action to elect a new chair-elect. Congratulations, Dr. McKnight. In addition, the board also took action for the review leads to address additional minor comments from today on the subsidence review, and then release it for a 60-day public comment period. For those who plan to provide written comments, please try to get those within a week. In terms of the September meeting, the goal is to submit a draft comment letter for the final EIR for the Delta Conveyance Project. So please keep a lookout for that and be prepared for discussion at that meeting. The FoodWeb's revised draft should also be released, and I think based off discussion from Bob, it'll likely be October if it's going to be mid-September, but if we make more progress, you might see it in September as well, but we'll continue to play that by ear. That's all I have for follow-up. Anything to add?
That sounds like it. I just want to say publicly, though, I'm going to give you a new draft on the EIR review.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Very good.
And
All
no
right.
comments on this one either.
No public comments on this. So that's it. We get to adjourn. Thank you all for making my last meeting a fun one. And my last meeting as chair, that is, not my last meeting. And we'll see you all next month.